lordship. In Arabic, we call this Tawheed al-Rububi, At-Tawheed al-Rububiyya. We can explain this concept by taking recourse to a few verses of the Holy Quran. In order to properly understand this concept, it's necessary to remember that when the Quran was revealed in the Arabian Peninsula, most of the pagan Arabs at that time admitted that God exists, that He is the creator of the worlds and the universe. This is something that we can gather from a lot of the verses of the Holy Quran. For example, in the 25th verse of Surah Luqman, God says the following, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَلَا إِن سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ لَيَقُولُنَّ اللَّهِ. If you ask them who created the heavens and the earth, they will say, it is God. Also in Surah Zumar, in the 38th verse of that surah, God says something similar, وَلَا إِن سَأَلْتَهُمْ مَنْ خَلَقَهُمْ لَيَقُولُنَّ اللَّهِ. If you ask them who created them, they would say God. So what exactly was the difference between the beliefs of these pagan Arabs and the Quranic beliefs, or the Tawheed and monotheism that the Prophet brought? The problem was this, that although these people admitted that God created the universe, they said that after God created the universe, He handed over the affairs of the universe to a series of demigods whose responsibility it was to oversee the affairs of the universe and take care of it. This was the main point of difference between them and the Quranic message. Because the Quran says that, no, just as God is the creator of the entire universe, He's also the creator of He's also the overseer and regulator and manager of the affairs of the entire universe. This was actually the reason why these pagan Arabs worshipped idols and these demigods, because they said that these are the beings that whose responsibility is to oversee our affairs, so we should worship them. In a similar manner, in the time of Hazrat Ibrahim, the Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, there were people who worshipped the stars and other astronomical bodies because they were of the opinion that these were the beings that had an influence in the world, right? And that the overseeing of the affairs of the realm of existence had been handed over to them. One of the beings of which was the human being. Even though it was God who had initially created man. It's for this reason that Hazrat Ibrahim, the Prophet Abraham, alayhi salam, when he was arguing with them, he denied this idea that these beings were the overseers of the affairs by stating that if they were the overseers of the affairs of the universe, these beings would not be subject to cessation and termination and setting. We were looking at the problem of God's lordship and unity in God's lordship on the key. Inshallah, in the forthcoming sessions, we'll look at this more. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Round the World with Reporters.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May. So we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. In struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a 0 hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her 3-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warn these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If everybody were housed, that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, Right to Housing, because they do the right thing.
This building in the center of Paris is entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. The solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Afghans are yet to wait for the rise of peace in their war-ravaged country, as the ongoing war in Afghanistan continues to claim the lives of large numbers of civilians, including women and children, on a daily basis. According to rights bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, over 30,000 civilians were killed and more than 60,000 others, including women and children, injured in the Afghan war over the past 11 years. All conflicting sides, including terrorist groups, U.S.-led NATO troops and pro-government forces are being blamed for these casualties. However, some international bodies like the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, and other independent bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, name chiefly terrorist groups accountable for much of these casualties. They also call on the Afghan government to bring the killers of Afghan people into justice via any possible legal attempt.
Unfortunately, nearly 100,000 civilians, including women and children, have fallen victim to the war in Afghanistan over the past 11 years. We call on the government to share its findings about these deaths and bring the accountable figures to justice.
This comes as experts believe there would be no zero civilian casualties unless the Taliban militant group changes its mind and accepts a new Afghanistan that differs from what it was before 2001.
Approval of a ceasefire by Taliban is highly important. They must realize that remaining indifferent to the suffering of people will have dire consequences.
Violence has been rising in Afghanistan amid intra-Afghan talks in Doha and U.S. troops withdrawal. Afghanistan remains in the 11 most dangerous nations list for children, according to Save the Children. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross reported last month that Afghanistan remains the deadliest country for civilians. Half of the civilian fatalities include Afghan women and children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the Eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of Northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbor, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Government leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal, as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal, as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. The administration of US President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led US Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record.
The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Human Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use our, have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population five times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity. But also disturbing signs of self-interest blame shifting and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
The New Jersey-based climate research organization, Climate Central, released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes, and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. We have prepared an article for you in this regard, written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Without Climate Action, Number of Low-Income Homes Affected by Flooding Projected to Triple by 2050, study shows. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Climate scientists have warned for years that millions of people living in coastal areas will be increasingly vulnerable to flooding in the coming decades, one of the many risks of policymakers failing to confront the climate crisis. But a new study details how people in low-income housing are expected to face the most drastic consequences of inaction. The New Jersey-based climate research organization Climate Central released a study on Tuesday, December 1st, showing that 7,668 houses, townhomes, and apartments that are either in low-income areas or are subsidized affordable housing units are currently exposed to at least one coastal flood risk event per year, and that number is expected to triple by 2050 if fossil fuel emissions are not dramatically reduced in the coming years. Analyzing maps of affordable housing across the U.S., researchers found that homes in New Jersey, New York, Massachusetts, and California are particularly at risk for flooding damage brought on by hurricanes and sea level rise. A rising tide lifts all boats is a phrase often used to articulate the idea that a prosperous economy will benefit all its participants, wrote Climate Central. But the rising tides, driven by global warming, are increasing flood threats for thousands of residents in low-income communities and neighborhoods. Flooding can wreak havoc on buildings and the residents who live in them, threatening public health and causing profound disruption to families struggling to make ends meet. Chronic or nuisance flooding can also damage cars and keep residents from getting to work, school, or medical care. Middle and high-income households are expected to be affected by flooding in the coming decades as well. But Climate Central noted that people living in affordable housing are more likely to be adversely affected, as affordable housing tends to be older and is rarely equipped with resilience-enhancing features such as flood-proofing, grid energy, or backwater valves due to the cost of such measures. Additionally, residents of affordable housing often lack the financial resources to repair, rebuild, or retreat from their housing after it is damaged by floodwaters, the group said. Flood-damaged affordable housing can have long-term consequences for residents, owners, and communities, including increased homelessness, loss of rental income that can make it difficult for housing owners to provide affordable housing, and neighborhood-level economic downturns. The study demonstrated that climate action is always a justice issue first, tweeted 350.org co-founder Bill McGibbon. We don't train our attention on these neighborhoods, but many of them are already suffering significantly from these problems. Benjamin Strauss, chief executive and chief scientist of Climate Central, told The Guardian. Since 1880, the mean sea level worldwide has climbed by about 8 inches. The rise has accelerated in some U.S. cities in the last century, increasing by about 1 foot. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, warned in a report in August that by the end of the century, the global sea level could rise more than 8 feet above 2000 levels if world governments don't take urgent action to reduce planet heating greenhouse gas emissions. Last month, scientists were startled to observe that a huge swath of Arctic sea ice in Siberia had yet to begin freezing for the year, among the latest signs that policymakers are not doing enough to rapidly reduce emissions. Climate Central's study served as a reminder that major climate-related events like hurricanes aren't the only challenges we need to consider, tweeted Sarah Stanley, Director of Communications at the U.S. Green Building Council. The quieter threat of sea level rise is already crippling communities, particularly the underserved.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena? And how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. Countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard. The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
will revive and will prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy. The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keep the government strong, keep the country or empire strong. But why the such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Bukong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the U.S. dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the U.K. And then the U.S., reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the U.S. and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly. It makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back, or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust the gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as the money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.